Okay, I want to continue with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. I thought we would even finish it today, the first Mishnah, and have a Siyum before Purim, but we're not going to do that. So, and I don't want to speak about Purim. There are plenty of recordings of past years of Purim or whatever. You can listen to them. Okay, good. So you can see Rebbe Zimbelsky if you want to. But I think if we don't, if we always stop for Pesach, Purim, and a host of other things, we'll never get to Pirkei Avos. So this year is Pirkei Avos, and that's what we're going to stick to. If I can somehow sneak in a little bit about Purim or Pesach in the Pirkei Avos, I'll try to do that. But we're not going to get off the topic, because that's why it took, I don't know how many years, to finish the 13 principles of faith. And Pirkei Avos, I project about 80, 90 years. That's if we don't digress. Okay. In any case, we're going to discuss this last phrase of the Mishnah, Asu Siog LaTorah, on two levels, just as we did on the other part of the Mishnah. The three things that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola said, they apply to institutionalized Klal Yisrael. They were telling over to the people who are responsible to give over the Mesorah, the tradition, to future generations, and they were charging them with Mesunim Badin, of having patience before they come to conclusions and judgments. They spoke to judges, they spoke to people who are responsible to formulate Torah decisions, and Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, having a lot of students, applied to Rosh Yeshiva, applied to the people who were functionaries in the institutions of Klal Yisrael. Similarly, Va'asu Siog LaTorah applies to those who are responsible for making the various safeguards to Torah, the rabbis of every generation, specifically the rabbis of the Talmud, who created and formulated many laws that were laws to protect the laws of the Torah. But we're also going to discuss it on a more personal level. All of these things also apply to every individual themselves. Right? A person has to be patient before he makes decisions and judgments, we explained. Everybody has a responsibility to be a teacher, like we explained last week, in some way. And now we're going to see that everybody in their personal life also have to make fences around the Torah for themselves. But that is not for today. That will be in the future. I just realized, as a bright note, next week I won't be late, because next week there is no class. Next week is Purim here in Yerushalayim. Okay, in any case, so the week after that we'll continue this, Amir Tzashem. In any case, let's speak about it now on the klal level. Okay, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola were speaking to the people, the Rabbonim, who are responsible to make the laws, the rabbinic laws, that govern Klal Yisrael. And they had a cue from the Torah. Asu mishmeres l'mishmarti, v'shamru mishmarti. You should observe my protection. And the Gemara learns out from that, Asu mishmeres l'mishmarti. God wanted the rabbis to see where they felt that people needed fences around the Torah to protect the Torah, and that the rabbis should institute those fences. There is a difference of opinion amongst the Rishonim, the Rambam and the Ramban, whether those fences are in fact Torah mandated or only rabbinically mandated. In other words, do we actually learn from that sentence that the Torah wanted the rabbis to create fences around the Torah, or that's only an asmachta? It's basically a rabbinical thing. The rabbis found a hint in the Torah for it. They found that the Torah expressed a will for it, but it's not actually Torah mandated. So therefore, when you listen to the rabbis, right, the Torah says that you have to apia Torah sheyorucha, whatever the rabbis tell you, you have to listen. What does that mean? Some say that it only applies to things that the rabbis explain to you what the Torah is. For instance, we don't know when it says not to do malacha on Shabbos. What does that mean? What kind of malacha? What does it mean not to work on Shabbos? What are the works? So the rabbis told us that they have a tradition, Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, that defined when God gave the Torah, he told Moshe Rabbeinu which works are prohibited. And that was passed down from generation to generation. So when the rabbis tell us this is the meaning of what the Torah said, don't do work, the 39 works that went in, the 39 activities that went into building the Mishkan, it's a mitzvah to believe them, and if you don't believe them and you don't follow what they say as an explanation of the Torah, then you transgress a Torah law. If you think Shabbos is something different than the rabbis tell you, you have your own idea about what we're allowed or not allowed to do on Shabbos, you are transgressing, aside from Shabbos, you're also transgressing a positive and negative commandment of the Torah, of Al Pi HaTorah Shiyorucha, of listening to the teachings of the rabbis, and Lo Yosur Mikol HaShiyorucha, and not deviating from what they say, a positive commandment, a negative commandment. But when the rabbis tell us rabbinical laws, they tell us this is not a Torah law. This is only rabbinic. And we're going to give you some examples in a second, what they are. So then, there is no Torah mitzvah to follow them. The Torah gave power to the rabbis to do this. They are invested with this power, but there's no specific mitzvah to listen to them, and therefore, if you don't listen to them, you are transgressing rabbinic prohibitions, but not Torah prohibitions. That's the Ramban. The Rambam says that there is a Torah mitzvah to listen to the rabbis, even when they tell you that the that this is only rabbinic. For instance, give an example. From the Torah, you're only not allowed to eat meat from a kosher domesticated mammal cooked in milk from a kosher domesticated mammal. That is the Torah prohibition. They have to be cooked together, and then the cooking is prohibited from the Torah. The eating of that product is prohibited, and having any benefit from it is prohibited. You can't feed it to your dog either. That is the Torah prohibition. The Torah did not prohibit eating milk and meat at the same meal. You can, from the Torah, have a salami sandwich with a glass of milk, there's no problem. You can even have a hamburger cold with a piece of cheese on it. No Torah prohibition, only rabbinic. Not only that, cooking fowl and milk, chicken and milk, is not prohibited from the Torah. You can take a chicken and cook it in milk with cheese or whatever, chicken cacciatore, is that
Kiev,
okay. So that is okay, because it's not a mammal. It's not a domesticated mammal. It has to be specifically a domesticated mammal, not a wild. Deer meat, you're allowed to cook in milk from the Torah. Don't get excited and go home and do it. It's prohibited from the rabbis. Just as much as you're not allowed to eat milk and meat in close proximity and even have to wait 6 hours after meat. Those are all rabbinic laws. So the rabbis told us, and we'll discuss the reason why they did this, not to make our lives more difficult, just the opposite, right? But the rabbi said the Torah prohibited cooking domesticated mammal meat in domesticated mammal milk. We are extending that to chicken also. It's one of the extensions. We don't want you to cook chicken in milk either. And that's only rabbinic. Now, if you eat, hold on to the questions. If you cook chicken and milk together and eat it, you're only transgressing a rabbinic prohibition. But the Rambam says you are also transgressing a Torah prohibition of not listening to the rabbis. Aside from the rabbinic prohibition of eating chicken cooked in milk, you also are transgressing a Torah mandate, because the Torah said listen to the rabbis. But they ask on that, we know there is a difference between rabbinic law and Torah law. For instance, where there's a doubt, This is oversimplifying it. It doesn't apply in every situation. There are qualifications, but for just to make it easier now, when you have a doubt whether something is kosher or not, and it's a Torah prohibition, then suffik d'oraisa l'chumra. You have to go to the stricter side and say it's prohibited. You have a piece of meat, you don't know if it's kosher or treif. You don't know. It could be kosher, it could be not kosher. So if it's a Torah prohibition, you have to go to the more strict side, assume it's treif, and not eat it. If it's only a rabbinic prohibition, then under certain circumstances, the halacha is suffik d'rabbanan l'kula. If it's only a doubt in a rabbinic thing, then the rabbi said that you can go to the more lenient side. You can assume it's kosher. Since you're not sure and it's only rabbinic, you can eat it. Again, it's oversimplified. It doesn't apply in every situation. Okay. But that's the rule. So they ask on the Rambam, if every rabbinic prohibition involves also a Torah prohibition of listening to the rabbis, then how could it be there be a difference between something that is prohibited from the Torah where there's a doubt, or something prohibited from the rabbis where there's a doubt, if everything prohibited by the rabbis is also automatically prohibited by the Torah because you have to listen to the rabbis? And that's a Torah prohibition. So if you have a piece of meat that may be rabbinically prohibited, if you eat it, it's also Torah prohibited because you're going against the rabbis. So one of the more simple answers to that question is very simple. The rabbis who told you that you can't eat that said, if there's a doubt, you could. So there's no more mitzvah to listen to the rabbis anymore and not eat it because the rabbis told you you could eat it. The same rabbis who told you that we don't want you to eat chicken cooked in milk, but if there's a doubt whether it was chicken cooked in milk, you could eat it. So there's no more mitzvah anymore not to eat it because of a doubtful rabbinic prohibition, because the rabbis told you that if it's a doubtful situation, we're telling you it's okay. They said. It's one way of understanding it. In any case, so this is whether these siyogim, these fences around the Torah, are for sure created by the rabbis. Whether there is a Torah mandate to listen to the rabbis to the point where if you don't, you transgress two Torah prohibitions, or those two Torah prohibitions only apply where the rabbis explain the Torah to you, but not where they add fences to the Torah. The fences added to the Torah gave the rabbis the power to do it, but it didn't mandate it with a specific mitzvah. That's the Ramban. So that's one difference of opinion. They also ask, how did the rabbis have the right to add things to the Torah? The Torah itself says you're not allowed to add anything to the Torah. And if the Torah said you're not allowed to cook mammal meat in mammal milk, and the rabbi said we're adding chicken to that, so aren't they adding to the Torah? Isn't that prohibited? That's baltosif. They're adding to the Torah. Or sometimes the rabbis, by making a fence, subtract it from the Torah. The Torah said that you have to hear shofar on Shabbos. If Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, you blow shofar. No reason why not. You take Esrog and Lulav on Sukkos if the first day falls on Shabbos. The rabbis came along and said, we're afraid that if we let people blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, that falls on Shabbos. Or take Lulav. And they extended that also to Megillah. If Megillah falls, if the Shushan Purim falls on Shabbos, because a regular Purim can't fall on Shabbos. But if Shushan Purim falls on Shabbos, like it does when there's a three-day Purim, you don't read the Megillah on Shabbos. Because we're afraid, the rabbi said, people are going to carry the Megillah or carry the Esrog and Lulav into a public domain. Or they're going to carry the shofar because they're not going to know how to do it. They're going to go learn. They're going to forget it's Shabbos. You end up carrying on Shabbos. Yontif, you're allowed to carry. So they prohibited blowing shofar, so they took away from the Torah. Torah said blow shofar. The rabbi said don't. So how do they have the right to add to the Torah and subtract from the Torah when the Torah itself said, lo so sifu velo sigru, don't add and don't subtract? So basically what the Mefarshim say is the following. The Rambam says this pretty clearly. He says that if the rabbis would come and tell you that not only did the Torah prohibit mammal meat and mammal milk, but it also prohibited chicken, then the rabbis would be adding on to the Torah. They'd be telling you something that the Torah didn't say, and they're adding to the Torah and making it a Torah prohibition. That they can't do. But if the rabbis come and say, the Torah only prohibited mammal meat, we're adding chicken. It's a rabbinic thing. Because we're afraid that if you cook chicken and milk, it's so similar to meat that you'll come to cook meat and milk. So we're putting a protective fence around the Torah. If the rabbis clearly tell us this is only rabbinic, this is not from the Torah, then they're not adding on to the Torah, but they're doing what the Torah said they have a right to do, make a fence around the Torah. Then it's okay. The same thing. The rabbis didn't come along and say, the Torah said it's prohibited to blow shofar on Shabbos. No, we're telling the Torah said it's permitted. You're allowed to blow shofar. There's a mitzvah to blow shofar. But we're telling you not to do it. Because we're afraid that if you blow shofar, which is a very nice mitzvah, you're going to come to do something worse and carry on Shabbos, which is much more devastating. So better no one should blow shofar on Shabbos than anyone ever should come to carry the shofar on Shabbos. So the rabbis are telling us, really, there is a mitzvah from the Torah. We're not taking away the mitzvah. The mitzvah is there. We're just telling you not to do it. Because we have the power to make fences around the Torah. So that is why the rabbinic prohibitions are not additions to the Torah, nor subtractions from the Torah, because the rabbis made it clear that it's only rabbinic. We are not adding something to the Torah. We're telling you that the Torah did not prohibit this. The Torah didn't say that this is something that you can't do or have to do. We're telling you that it is from the Torah, either permitted, and we're the ones who are prohibiting it. We're the ones telling you you're not allowed to do it. So we're not adding anything to the Torah. We are doing what the Torah guided us to do, or directed us to do, or commanded us to do, to make fences around the Torah. Now, this concept of fences around the Torah troubles many people. Because they say, you know, all these rabbinic laws, if it wouldn't be for these rabbinic laws, Judaism would be much easier. All right, I'm going to give you some examples of how easy it would be. Okay, aside from eating chicken and milk, right, and eating milk and meat at the same meal, and not having to wait 6 hours, that's nothing. But you know, if it wouldn't be for rabbinic prohibitions, you could get up Erev Pesach, before the time that you're not allowed to eat chametz. You don't have to clean your house, you don't have to do anything, even to a certain degree you don't have to change your dishes. And you just have to say, all the chametz I have in my house, in my cupboards, or whatever, is considered like dust of the earth. And that's it. From the Torah, that's all you have to do. And mean it. And if you really mean it, then you don't have to clean out your cupboards. Just can't eat that chametz over Pesach. And it's all like dust of the earth. You're not over Bali Ruah and Bali Masi of having, owning chametz. Just not allowed to eat it. Could be that your dishes, since a day passed without using them. So anything that's in the dishes is already not considered edible, and Torah-wise, you're allowed to use those dishes even on Pesach, even though we use for chametz the whole year. It's only rabbinic that you can't. So the rabbis came along and said, you have to get rid of your chametz, or you have to sell it to a goy, and you got to put it behind the lock and key, you know, and you have to go and search your house for chametz and clean everything well. It's all rabbinic. I don't go home hating the rabbis today, but that's all rabbinic. So the rabbis made our lives really miserable, because if it wouldn't have been for those rabbis, I could, you know, really get up Erev Pesach and be invigorated and just say, oh, my chametz is dust of the earth, and that's it. So why did the rabbis do that? Because they were afraid. The people would say that, but they wouldn't mean it. And if you don't mean it, it doesn't take effect. And then you are transgressing the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. So they wanted you to get it out of your house physically. Get rid of it. Sell it to a goy. There you don't have to mean it. You sold it. It's a sale. Right? But to rely on just saying it in your heart, the Torah said that if you do it, it's okay. But we're afraid that people are not going to live up to that. So the rabbis have to deal with people. Torah deals with the ideal situation. Ideal people. The rabbis have to deal with people who are less than ideal. Believe me, we have to deal with people less than ideal. And that is the basic idea of a fence around the Torah. So same thing. If it would be from the Torah, the only thing you couldn't do is eat or have any benefit from milk and meat cooked together. You could eat milk and meat at the same meal, as long as you don't cook them together. You could eat milk and meat one before the other and after the other. You could drink milk right after and together with a salami sandwich. You could cook chicken in milk if you wanted to. You could cook deer meat in milk. No problem. Right? All of these things would be permissible. Even meat and milk. As long as you didn't cook it, you could soak it in meat and milk and eat the meat without cooking. Or cook the meat first, let it cool down, soak it in milk, and then eat together. No Torah prohibition. All of that is only rabbinic. So the rabbis really added a lot of things to make our lives much more difficult, seemingly. Right? The answer to that is that I always like to compare it to the following. Imagine people are up on a mountain, and there is an area of, let's say, 100 yards by 100 yards that the top of the mountain contains. But the end of the mountain is a sheer drop of 1,000 feet. So if by mistake you get too close to the end of the mountain and you fall off, it's going to be very, very not good. Okay, falling 1,000 feet straight down will not be good for you. And somebody comes and he realizes this is a very dangerous situation because you could wander off, especially at night, or if you're involved in something else and talking to people, and you walk to the end of the mountain and you forget that it's the end of the mountain and you then walk off the mountain. That's very devastating. So a person comes and he puts up a fence and takes away a good portion of the area that you can walk around the mountain, because now you can only walk up till the fence. What idiot is going to say, hey, made it harder for you to fall off the mountain? Right? Yeah, he did make it harder for you to fall off the mountain. But falling off the mountain is not a great thing to do. So he made it harder. So he took away a little of your ability-free movement, but he did it in order that you don't fall off the mountain. The rabbis were so aware of how serious it is to transgress a Torah prohibition, to eat milk and meat cooked together, and they realized that if we allow people to cook chicken and meat, then people are going to be confused, and some people are going to say, well, what's the difference between that and meat? Meat is meat. And they'll come to cook meat and milk, and that is devastating. So they made a fence, and they said that we're going to limit your ability to function. We're not going to let you cook chicken and milk, so that's taking away a little bit of your free movement, but we're doing it because you don't come to cook meat and milk, which is devastating. You don't fall off the mountain. The rabbis realized how serious it is, even unintentionally, inadvertently, to do something prohibited, and therefore they made the fences for our protection. They're not to make life harder. They make it to make it harder falling off the mountain. If that's called making life harder, then it's making life harder. But if you understand how serious it is to fall off the mountain, and the person who put up the fence is protecting you from falling off the mountain, then the rabbis aren't doing you harm, they're doing you good. That is basically the philosophy of the fences around the Torah. The Rabbanan, and therefore keeping rabbinic laws is even sometimes more serious than keeping Torah laws. Because a person who doesn't keep a Torah law, he doesn't whatever, he has a Yetzer Hara or whatever. But sometimes the motivation for not keeping a rabbinic law is because you don't believe in it, because you don't think it's so important. And that means you don't think the Torah law is so important. So it's a function of lack of Yirah Shamayim, lack of fear of heaven. And that's much more serious than committing a sin because you had a Yetzer Hara, because you had a Taiva, because you had some desire to do something wrong. But we don't believe how serious it is. We don't believe in the power that the rabbis have. It's a question of belief that's much more serious than a sin that you do because you were weak and you couldn't control yourself. So therefore, sometimes transgressing a rabbinic prohibition, where the motivation to transgress it is because I don't believe it's so serious to do something wrong from the Torah. I don't need these fences. Or I don't believe the rabbis have the power. That's a much more serious sin than sinning in an action because you couldn't control yourself, because you had this desire and you couldn't overcome it. So therefore, sometimes rabbinic prohibitions are even more serious to transgress than Torah prohibitions. And in fact, the rabbis say that a person who transgresses a rabbinic prohibition is liable to a death penalty, not a physical death penalty, but a spiritual death penalty. So next time in Yirtzeh Hashem, I wish you all a Freilich and Purim, and next time in Yirtzeh Hashem, we will continue with this idea. Yeah.
What happens when
there's a machlokas amongst the rabbanim, and the Torah gave ways of solving those machlokas. Well, it's not for now. I'm on one foot. Save the question. We will answer it at some point.